Send Master Harry to me. Colonel Morton filled his glass from the decanter, held it up to the light, and then slowly sipped the contents. A dark shade of thought upon his bronzed face. The door of the dining room opened, and the colonel set down his glass as he looked at the boy who came into the room. He was a well-built lad, finely developed, strong and active. Handsome indeed was the face, with its well-marked features and large, dark eyes. But there was a cloud upon it, and in the dark eyes was a glint of suspicion and defiance. The whole manner of the boy was one of suppressed hostility, and the colonel realized it keenly enough, without words being spoken. "You sent for me, Uncle?" "Yes, Harry." Colonel Wharton's voice was very mild. "Sit down, my boy. I want to speak with you." "I suppose you're not going to keep me long," said the boy doggedly. "I want to go out on my pony before dark." The colonel half rose from his seat, a flush of anger darkening his cheeks. "Sit down," he thundered. "Now, Harry," said the colonel, in a more kindly voice, "I want to speak to you seriously. I hope you will take all I'm going to say in a friendly spirit. I am your uncle. You are the only son of my only brother, and you should understand that I have your truest interests at heart." The boy's lips curled slightly, but he did not speak. "I have come home from India," resumed the colonel, slightly raising his tone, "to find that you have run completely wild under the charge of my sister. And I should not be doing my duty to my dead brother if I did not take you in hand, and make at least an attempt to put you on a better road. Your education has been neglected. I have, therefore, come to a new decision, Harry, which is what I want to tell you about now. I'm going to send you to school." Harry Wharton's face fell. "To school?" "Yes, to school. I have written to Dr. Locke, the headmaster of Greyfriars, the school where I was educated, and he is ready to receive you. You will go to Greyfriars tomorrow morning."
Harry Wharton, of course, went to Greyfriars, really, in 1908. That was when I wrote the first magnet. Greyfriars gradually grew. It was a much smaller school when it started. Actually, there would be three or four houses. But then, in a story, you've got to cut out the unessentials. You see, if you put in four houses, it doesn't affect the action of the story, but it does add four housemasters unnecessarily to the scene. Well, nobody wants to know whether Smith Mayne was in Jones's house and whether Monson Major was in Mr. Robinson's house. They don't want to know all that. They don't want to be burdened with it. They want a story to read. So you cut out all the unessentials. Billy Bunting was invented, if you can call it invented, as far back as 1899. I had to see an editor then, and I took him several sketches. Among them was Bunter. And he looked them all over and chose something else. So I slipped Bunter back into my coat pocket, and that was that. And he remained in cold storage for nearly 9 years. And then one day, the gem editor called me up to the office and told me he was starting a new paper and I was to write for it. And I said I would, and did. And then, when I was doing the first number, I remembered my old Bunter. So I just inserted him in the first story. But he was a very minor character to begin with.
Harry Wharton sprang straight at the bully, only to reel back from a sharp left-hander that caught him on the point of the chin. He sat down with a jar to every bone in his body. "Ha, ha, ha!" roared Bulstrode. "How's that? Will you have some more?" Harry did not reply or rise from the carpet. He was too dazed by the shock. As he sat there, another junior belonging to the lower fourth came hurriedly into the study and ran right into him. The newcomer was a somewhat stout junior, with a broad face and a pair of large spectacles. "Yarroo!" roared the junior, as he sprawled on the floor over Harry's legs. "What's that in the way? What do you mean by having a dog in the study, you silly bounders?" "Ha, ha, ha!" howled Bulstrode. Billy Bunter looked round as he rose, and peered closely at Harry through his big glasses. It was pretty clear that, big as his spectacles were, they did not assist his vision very much.
My hat! It's the new kid! Well, what does he mean by sprawling on the floor? I say, you new fellow!
What Billy Bunter was going to say remained a mystery, for the new boy shoved him violently aside and sprang to his feet.
Bunter is certainly the stupidest boy in the room, but he has rather a gift of cunning. He is simple, but at the same time a little sly. Oh, yes, always unsuccessful.
There were three removed fellows in the rag, Skinner, Snoop, and Stott, frousting about as usual. Bunter gave them a morose blink.
I say, Skinner, old chap, think you can do that translation? Infandum regina jubes renovare delorum?
If I couldn't, I'd ask the head to shove me back into the third form, answered Skinner.
Well, I know you're a dab at Latin, old fellow. Cleverest fellow in the form, come to that, said Bunter. Wharton thinks he's a dab at it, but he isn't in the same street with you, Skinner. You're really clever at it. Ah, I fancy you know as much as Quelch, or more, too. Ah, I say, what does that rotten verse mean? You might tell a chap.
And get detention on Founder's Day, asked Skinner.
How's Quelch to know, urged Bunter. You can say you didn't if he asks you. Wharton or Toddy would make a fuss about telling lies to a beak, but you don't mind, do you, old chap? I mean to say, you ain't so jolly particular, are you? You often tell whoppers, so one more won't hurt you, old chap.
How nicely you put it, Bunter, said Skinner, while Snoop and Stott chuckled. You sort of make a fellow yearn to help you out. Dashed if I don't risk it. Now let's see. Infandum, regina, jubes, renovare delorum. The jujubes renew the pain of the Queen's infant. Skinner, Snoop, and Stott exchanged glances. It was not easy for the young rascals to suppress a yell of laughter at the idea of Bunter taking that extraordinary translation to Mr. Quelch.
Well, that's all right, said the fat owl. Of course, I knew that was what it meant, Skinner. I'm pretty good at Latin. I just wanted to make sure. You haven't helped me at all, really. I knew it all the time.
And having thus expressed his gratitude for services rendered, Billy Bunter rolled out of the rag and headed for Mr. Quelch's study. Bunter tapped cheerfully at Mr. Quelch's door and rolled into his formmaster's study, his paper in his fat hand. Mr. Quelch fixed a grim, inquiring glance upon him. Have you brought me your translation, Bunter?
Oh, yes, sir. Here it is, sir.
If anyone has helped you with it, Bunter?
Oh, no, sir. I never asked any of the fellows, and they never said they wouldn't. I did it entirely by myself, sir. It wasn't very hard, sir, when I came to do it, sir.
You may hand it to me, Bunter. Mr. Quelch gazed at it, with an expression on his face that the fabled Gorgon of ancient times might have envied. Billy Bunter, blinking at him, felt an inward misgiving that Skinner must have got it wrong somehow.
Upon my word, said Mr. Quelch at last, Bunter, you obtuse boy. I refuse to believe that even you are capable of stupidity to this extent. This is impertinence. I shall administer the most condign punishment.
He rose to his feet and picked up his cane.
Bunter, bend over that chair. Oh, crikey, gasped Bunter. I say, isn't that right, sir? Bend over that chair, thundered Mr. Quelch.
Bunter sagged dismally over the chair.
Swipe, swipe, swipe. Yahoo! Ow, ow, ow!
There was a rhythmic sound of cane contacting trousers and a series of howls. It was a sad and sorrowful fat owl who tottered away from Mr. Quelch's study, folded up almost like a pocket knife. Billy Bunter had succeeded in dodging a spot of work, but from the bottom of his fat heart, he wished he hadn't.
Bunter's greediness has no limit. He's very fond of jam. He's very fond of jam tarts, cake, buns, eclairs, and everything else in the edible line.
Bunter stepped cautiously along to Loder's study.
He whipped into that study and shut the door after him. On the study table stood the basket and the parcel. One containing almost infinite strawberries, the other a huge pot of cream. Oh, crumbs, gasped Bunter. He shoved a fat paw into the basket to begin with. A dozen strawberries vanished on the spot. They were delicious. They were, in fact, scrumptious. They melted in Bunter's mouth. Gobble, gobble, gobble. Gorgeous, breathed Bunter. Still gobbling strawberries, he turned the key in the door, in case any chance comer should look in. Any such person, finding the door locked, would only suppose that Loder had locked it when he went out. But Bunter's luck was in. Nobody came. He was left in peace and plenty. Gobble, gobble, gobble. He borrowed a spoon and a bag of caster sugar from Loder's study cupboard. He sat at Loder's table on one of Loder's chairs and hardly paused for a moment. There were almost endless strawberries. There was almost unlimited cream. Strawberries and cream. Cream and strawberries went on the downward path, and Billy Bunter's fat face grew shinier and stickier as he breathed happy contentment. But even Bunter slowed down before he got to the end of that immense supply of strawberries and cream. The tuck was too delicious to leave. He was not going to leave one strawberry or half a spoonful of cream, but he had to slacken speed. He was feeling full, perhaps a little too full. He was disregarding the plimsoll line even more recklessly than usual.
Bunter wanders from the truth without realizing what he's doing. He doesn't realize that he's a liar. He's very indignant if his word is doubted. Very indignant indeed. The other fellows call them fibs or crammers, but it's understood that Bunter is not conscious of being a liar or of being a young rascal. He thinks he's a very fine fellow. In fact, he thinks that he's really the only decent fellow at Greyfriars and all the rest are more or less beasts. Bunter is a combination of three persons. His circumference was borrowed from an editor. He overflowed the arms of his armchair, and how he ever got into that chair and out again, I never knew. But his circumference struck me very strongly, and I handed it on to Bunter. One was a relative of mine who used to peer at me through his spectacles like an owl. That's where he got his spec. And another was another relative who was always expecting a cheque, which never arrived, and in the meanwhile was very anxious to borrow a pound. That became Bunter's post order. When Bunter rolled casually off the typewriter in 1908, I couldn't foresee he'd still be talked about in 1961. Never crossed my mind for a moment. What I should do without him, I really don't know. Sometimes I can hardly believe that there really isn't a boy named Bunter. It's hard to believe that he doesn't exist. I liked the idea of making a coloured boy a friend on equal terms with the other boys and a valued member of the co. Well, I thought it had a good effect. I went to read as an Indian actor, of course, though they sometimes raise objections to Harry Singh's English. I had a letter some time ago from an Indian schoolmaster. He told me that he had never heard any Indian speak English precisely like Harry Dempsey Ramsey. Oh, no doubt he was right. Of course, you can see it's highlighted. It's made comical on purpose. It isn't a complete invention, because Hindus, so far as my acquaintance with them go, do sometimes make the most extraordinary blunders in English. For instance, a Hindu once said to me, oh, a long time ago, early in the 1890s, he said, top of a beautiful morning. Well, that isn't customary English, is it? I've made Harry Singh say that. But of course I've extended it a bit. I've never heard a Hindu say that the samefulness is terrific, certainly. But you must make a thing entertaining.
The Nabob grinned. Don't trouble your brainful mind about the papalness, my respectable chum, he said.
I consider it regardfully as a loanful sum. As your famous poet Shakespeare says, what's in a nameful designation? A rose by any other name would be more in heaven and earth than your philosophy.
Ha, 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 roared Bob Cherry. Is that Shakespeare, Hurry Singh?
Certainly, my uproarious and ludicrous chum. It is in the great poet Shakespeare's works, which I studied under my esteemed native instructor in Bengal, before I had the honorable happiness to visit these shores.
Well, I rather think your esteemed instructor was an esteemed ass. You got it all mixed.
Hari Singh shook his head gently.
He was the best-tempered and most placable junior at Greyfriars, but he could be firm. And he was always especially firm upon his knowledge of the English language and the works of the British poets.
I think you are slightly mistaken, my esteemed Cherry, he replied. That is how I learned it under my respectable instructor. I have noticed that many English people have not the deepful knowledge of the famous and justly esteemed Shakespeare. I have studied his works in Bengal, from the Tradesman of Venice to a dreamful summer midnight.
Ha ha ha, chortled Bob Cherry. Jampot, old man, your esteemed instructor in Bengal ought to have been presented with a tin medal and a prize stick ear.
Fish a tea fish is founded on an American drummer, you know, what they call a commercial traveler. But that drummer, I suppose, must have been middle-aged. And, of course, Fish wasn't like him except in his characteristics. I've done other American boys, quite nice ones. There was Lincoln G. Poindexter at one time. And, of course, he's forgotten, and Fisher T. Fish is remembered. Fisher T. Fish does speak his own language, as spoken by other Americans. You make an American jump, and he's quite likely to say wake snake.
Say, you got a cute little shebang here, Wharton, remarked Fisher T. Fish, as he glanced round the hall of Wharton Lodge and made a rapid mental calculation of the value of the furnishings thereof. Cute, I allow, continued Fishy. But that ain't denying that you could put the whole shebang inside the garage at my papa's mansion on Riverside Drive, New York.
What about a spot of skating, asked Harry Wharton, laughing. I can lend you some skates, Fishy, and the ice is all right on the lake.
You said it, agreed Fishy.
The Co. walked Fisher T. Fish down to the lake in the park. Arriving at the lake, Fishy glanced round him, as if in search of something.
Where's the lake? He asked.
Blind? Asked Johnny Bull with a grunt.
Ah, you call this a lake?
Asked Fishy.
This little pond? You should give my papa's lake the once over. I guess it would make you open your optics some.
Might think it was Bunter talking. If Bunter talked through his nose, remarked Johnny Bull. Try these skates, Fishy, said Wharton hastily. Fisher T. Fish got on the skates. He was still getting them on when the famous five slid out on the ice. Fisher T. Fish watched the gyrations of the skaters with the superior smile of a guy who could do things.
Say, Cherry, big boy,
he called. Hello, hello, hello.
You call that skating?
Just our poor little efforts in that line, agreed Bob, whose good temper was proof against almost anything. Hop on and show us how to do it, Fishy.
Just the idea, said Fisher T. Fish. I'll mention that skating is just where I live. I'll say that I'll sure be pleased to show you guys a thing or two.
Go it! Fisher T. Fish went it. He slid out on the ice, but for some reason, his bony legs seemed to desire to fly in different directions. He slid, he slipped, he gyrated on one leg, and he yelled.
Oh! Give a guy a hand! Gee whiz! Whoop!
Fisher T. Fish spun about frantically, charged into Bob Cherry and grabbed him convulsively around the neck.
Here, look out, yelled Bob, struggling wildly. If that's how it's done, Fishy, I don't want you to show me any more. Oh, I guess I'm going. Oh, jumping toads. I'll say this is the rhinoceros's whiskers. Oh, carry me home to die. Wake, snakes. Yaroo!
Vernon Smith has some very good qualities. He's got plenty of pluck, and he will stick to anybody in a jam, and he's capable, and he's a good man at games. He's reckless, headstrong, self-willed. He's given to gambling, to backing horses, and when he can get across to France, he plays in the casino.
Herbert Vernon Smith stood very still. He had rather a stunned feeling. Was his system, after all, mere moonshine? He would not believe it. He had more money about him, though he had not expected to have to use it. A glance round brought the ever-ready changeur to his side. £4 more, all he had, was exchanged for counters. And the bounder, with a set face and a steely look in his eyes, recommenced. And, though he still clung to his faith in his darling system, the new supply followed the rest, and once more he stood, looking on with black rage in his heart. He moved away from the table. He was tired and nervy with the excitement. But the spirit of gambling had taken entire possession of him. His only thought was to carry on, to force the game his way, to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. There was only one resource, and he went slowly back into the concert hall to look for Tom Redwing. Redwing was still where he had left him. He looked up as a hand fell on his shoulder. "Smithy," he murmured. He was glad to see his friend again, but sorely troubled by the hard, bitter look on his face. He did not need to ask how the play had gone. "Lend me some money, Tom."
"But will you lend me some money?"
The bounder's voice was a whisper, and it sounded almost like the hiss of a snake in its intensity. "I've had a run of rotten luck, but it's all right. It only needs time. Will you lend me some money?"
"But old chap..."
No one could have guessed that Tom Redwing was Smithy's best pal, indeed his only pal, from the look that the bounder gave him.
"You fool," he muttered. "You nincompoop! Are you going to sermonize me now? Will you lend me some money or not?"
"I've only £3.
"Lend it to me."
Redwing hesitated for one moment. He knew, as very likely Smithy knew at the bottom of his heart, that this only meant that Redwing's money was to be thrown after the bounders. He did not care for the money. He only wanted Smithy to chuck it. But the mingling of anger, misery, eagerness, pleading in Smithy's face was too much for him. Silently, he passed the money into the bounder's hand. Without a word, the bounder left him.
"My father, old chap, he used to write. As far as I know, he never got as far as publication. But, he had a lot of learned books about. Well, when I was a little kid, I taught myself the Greek alphabet, and I thought if I learned the Greek alphabet, I should be able to read his books." "Very funny." "Of course, as a boy, I used to read Tom Brown's School Days, but I had to skip the stodgy chapters, the humbug. And, of course, at its time, I liked Stalky and Co. And, as a boy, I used to read Talbot Baynes Reid. I liked him. Some of his stuff was jolly good. No, don't read much modern stuff. I liked reading George Orwell, although I don't agree with him on a single thing. But, after all, he could write, you know, George Orwell could. Jolly good writer. But I disagree with nearly everything he says. Well, I like his cool story better than anything else, even at my present age. I can still read Talbot Baynes Reid, and occasionally I have a look into Stalky and Co. And even into Tom Brown. There's two or three good chapters in Tom Brown, well worth reading. But I don't like novels. I didn't think very much of Thackeray Dickens. Of course, I loved when I was young. I don't care for him so much now. Some of Dickens' stuff is splendid. Oh, fancy anybody saying a Sam Weller was out of date. A Sam Weller is alive. I mean, you know the chap. Even old Pickwick is a living character. At Sam Weather, we know just as well as we know our nearest relations. Funny thing, I couldn't ride a character like that. Not possible. Never had a character anything like Sam Weller. Yeah, well, I can see how jolly good he is. And Shakespeare, of course, I used to revel in Shakespeare at one time, but I find some faults in him now. For one thing, he's too long-winded. Another thing, in many of his plays, he's too involved. And another thing, I'm afraid he was a bit of a snob. For instance, in Macbeth. You know, Macbeth feels terrific remorse for murdering Duncan. But not a spot of remorse for murdering the two grooms. They were, he was a beastly snob, wasn't he? I mean, they were both alive and then dead. Just as much as Duncan. Nobody ever wrote like I do. Whether it's good or bad or indifferent, it's quite individual. Can't imagine anybody who's ever written in my style. There's a faint resemblance, perhaps, here and there to Macaulay. That's why I used to devour Macaulay when I was a boy. And that may have influenced me to some extent. But I couldn't bracket myself with anybody. Solitary specimen. Koh-i Noor. I know it sounds utterly absurd at my time of life, but when I'm sitting at the typewriter, I'm only 16 years old. Oh, yes, I live a great way. I remember once in Italy, when I came down to lunch, they told me there'd been an earthquake shock. I hadn't noticed it. Yeah, I was a great person at the time. Ah, I always said I'd go back to Naples to die. Oh, it is lovely in Italy. The climate, simply lovely. You feel as well as anything there. You get lovely weather from the beginning of February. Bit different from what we get here. And it was nice in my time at Monte Carlo. I don't know what it's like now. Let's see, it was before the First War anyway. Was it before the First War? Yes, it was before the First War. Oh, I had a long campaign there once. Stayed for about 3 months. I was in the casino every afternoon and evening. Or nearly everyone. I remember I had to stick my editors for some checks in advance, see me through. And when it was all over, I had just enough money to pay my hotel bill and hire a car to get off into Italy. If you're going to write stories, you must know the subject you're going to write about. And what is the use of warning anybody against gambling if you don't know what gambling is? At least you must go through something or other once or twice. I mean, a man who has never heard of a pack of cards couldn't warn you against playing euchre, could he? My mind is stored with all sorts of things that come in, useful at various times. Well, as this is this here, I heard a socialist orator say that once. I think it was on that tub at Hyde Park Corner, 70 years ago, I should think. One of the early socialists, and he was waving his arms. What I says is this here. That went right off to Gosling.
What I says is this here, sir. Fair play is a jewel.
Mr. Quelch was busy that afternoon. He was at work on a pile of form papers when the ancient porter of Greyfriars School tapped at his door and shuffled into his study. The removed master's pen remained suspended in the air, like Mahomet's coffin, as he gazed inquiringly at Gosling. Gosling stood shuffling his feet, his ancient hat in his hand, and looked disconcerted and uncomfortable.
"It's like this here, sir," said Gosling. "Boys is boys, which is to say young sweeps. But fair play's a jewel. What I says is this here, sir. That there young bunter never did it."
"And what do you mean, Gosling?"
"Just what I says, sir. All this here talk about young bunter are idling himself away, sir. I hears about it and I ask some of the young sweeps. Oh, I mean the young gentlemen, sir. What it's all about. And it fair give me a turn, sir, when I hears that young Bunter is out to be flogged, sir, along with that there tomato.
Mr. Quelch drew a deep, deep breath. Do you mean that you know anything about that episode at the gates on Monday afternoon, Gosling? He asked.
I never see no episode, sir. Not knowing what it might be if I did see it, answered Gosling. I ain't come here to tell you nothing about no episode, sir, but about a tomato.
That was the episode to which I allude, Gosling.
Oh. Well, I ain't never heard a tomato called episode before, sir,
said Gosling.
It's a new word to me, sir.
Mr. Quelch bestowed upon him a glance which the fabled basilisk of old might well have envied. Will you kindly tell me what you know about the matter, Gosling?
Yes, sir. That's why I come here. As soon as I heard that there young Bunter was up for it, explained Gosling. I never knowed it had happened at all till I was told on it 10 minutes ago. But seeing how I was, I knowed at once, of course, how that tomato happened to hit Mr. Hacker in the hay.
Do you mean that it was not Bunter who threw the tomato, as Mr. Hacker supposed? Exclaimed Mr. Quelch.
Of course he didn't, sir.
Do you know who did?
Of course I do.
Then who was it? Cried Mr. Quelch quite eagerly.
Me, sir,
said Gosling. You? Quelch almost bounded from his chair. You? What do you mean, Gosling? You threw a tomato at the master of the upper fourth? Impossible! Gosling, have you been drinking?
Of course I never throwed it at Mr. Hacker, sir,
said Gosling.
Me at my time of life played tricks with tomatoes? Of course I didn't. It was a accident.
Bless my soul, said Mr. Quelch.
Well, of the whole staff at Greyfriars, I think Mr. Quelch is my favourite. I like him. As a matter of fact, of course, he's drawn from real life. Although he's dead now, of course. Well, the fact that the Greyfriars Latin is so frequently referred to does naturally reflect my own tastes. Yes, I was always keen on the classics. And as a matter of fact, I've written a Bunter story in Latin. It was published recently in the Times Educational Supplement. There was one little difficulty. Yaru cannot be translated into any language but English.
Pungere! Vox quelci non clara sed profunda est. Nil responsu. Pungere! Pungere! Num dormis in classe, Pungere! Etiam nunc respondet, punturus nihil. Contractio supercili quelci nigrior fit. Ferula excrinio sumta, punturum apropinquat. Omnino ignorat, punturus, placide somnient. Sed repente suscitabita. Ubi ferula in articulos digitorum acrita descendit. Tum punturus saltat.
Yaru!
Clamat.
Quid est? Bestia!
Et punterus stupens articulos digitorum vehementa fricat.
Ha ha ha!
Rident omnes pueri.
Ow, ow, ow!
Inhalat punterus.
Yahoo!
In the earlier days, I never thought anything at all about popularity with the public. I just went on with my job. Editors never meddled. Every now and then an editor would suggest a subject. For instance, he would suggest that they should all go to Hollywood. So they all went to Hollywood, stayed there 12 weeks. But he didn't suggest how it was to be done. I don't suppose he knew how it was to be done. Everything would happen according to the characters and the circumstances. Given those surroundings and given those characters, what happened would happen. And of course the circumstances and the characters might be in themselves a little improbable, but given them, everything has to be perfectly logical and fitting. Wilde said once that nature imitates art. Well, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. It is extraordinary the number of things I write that happen soon after I've written them. Quite extraordinary. Sometimes a series lasts for 12 weeks, sometimes for only 6. I mean, sometimes there'll be a couple of numbers, a couplet. Then there might be single numbers. And you begin afresh with every new story. It's a different story about the same period. For instance, when an old boy comes to Greyfriars. Well, actually, of course, he would have been contemporary with Bunter 10 years earlier. But he isn't. I have occasionally had questions about that. Why did a grow-up pass through their performance? I remember a chap did that once in a paper I was writing for. He had a character named Bob Redding, and then he had young Bob Redding, and the old Bob used to come as his father to the school. But I didn't like it, and I don't think other readers liked it. And it couldn't go on forever, because by this time it'd be their great-great-grandsons. And you couldn't have an array of grandfathers and great-grandfathers, could you? No, it's better to make a clean cut. They don't grow any older at all. Ah, oh, Arthur Clarke could draw. He was the first magnet artist, and he did the first spunter, and I nearly jumped for joy when I saw him, because he got him so exactly. He was marvellous. And that's a pattern they've all followed since. Well, there must have been 10 or 12 or 15 others. MacDonald and Chapman were the chief. Well, the artist should study the story and evolve a picture in his mind and draw that picture. But he doesn't because he's too damn lazy. You can't get artists to read typescript with concentration. You see, every artist can see Bunter because he's so outstanding. But the chap who draws the pictures, all the other characters are much of a muchness, and he just shoves them in. You can always tell Smithy because he has a jutting nose. And you can tell Inky, that's how he's seeing, because of his complexion. But the others, you know, you can't tell one from another. I prefer a book without pictures. They don't give you your own idea of the character. And I believe a reader likes to form his own mental picture and stick to it. And a picture that doesn't agree with it is disconcerting. A name must call the character to mind. If Billy Bunter had been named Bertie Montmorency, he wouldn't have gone across at all. Couldn't have. There used to be, when I was a kid, something called Bunter's Nervine. Some kind of quack medicine. I never came across it, but I used to see it advertised. And I think that must have put the name into my mind. And also the words Billy Bunter suggested themselves. Somebody who was fairly plump. Wharton indicates Wharton. Cherry, now you see that indicates a quite different kind of character. And it is true that Cherry's name might have been Jones in real life, but that won't do in fiction. Fiction has to have much more sense than real life. Things have to be more appropriate. Now, Bull, for instance, suggests a certain solidity, strength and obstinacy, doesn't it? Well, that's what Johnny Bull is. He's a good chap, but he's rather obstinate and given to saying, I told you so. In the early years, I doubt whether there were grown-up readers at all. But that began, I should think, after about 10 years. And then I used to hear from middle-aged people and even old people sometimes. Many old readers have told me that they read The Magnet as boys and enjoyed it, and read it again 20 years later and found an immense amount of stuff in it that they'd never suspected in boyhood. The actual fact is that if you want to write for boys, you must write for adults. You can't write down to a boy. He spots you at once and throws the thing aside. And if there's anything he doesn't understand, he's perfectly willing to pass it over without understanding it. He thinks that's something the author knows that he doesn't. For instance, when I put any Latin into a story, I'm very careful to work in the translation in subsequent dialogue. I have a lot of spare time now, and I occupy it pretty well. I do spots of gardening. A year or two ago, I grew beautiful tulips, but they haven't gone on this year. But chiefly, I'm afraid, I sit a great deal in an armchair. But I have many occupations, such as turning popular songs into Latin. I have a whole collection here. This is from How Happy Could I Be With Either. Si proculis et ultra libet, gaudere gemant alteram. Sed quod simul me vexatis ambae, Neutral liquid ego decum. Greyfriars, it is a life of innocence. It's as things should be. It's no good saying they are exactly like that, because we know they're not. But it's as things should be and might be. And the more you impress that upon the reader's mind, the more things are likely to be like that. George Orwell said somewhere, throughout the whole range, there's no mention of sex. Well, of course, there shouldn't be. You don't want to put that into young heads. They're doing too much of that now, and the result is juvenile delinquency. No. Don't like juvenile delinquents. There have been occasional bad characters who fell to temptation, but they were soon got rid of. The fact is, I can't draw a character that is thoroughly bad in any way whatever. I believe in the use of the cane at school. I don't quite see how boys, real boys, could ever be kept in order without it. Because occasionally a fellow gets what they call a book and has to write out a whole book of Virgil. But that's very rare, only for very serious offences. Smoking is bad. You mustn't smoke. Well, boys ought not to smoke. It stunts their growth. I think it's a very good thing to impress upon young readers that they shouldn't smoke. Well, the sight of a boy of 15 smoking a cigarette is an absurdity. Drink never comes into the stories at all. Well, I've been a teetotaler except for whiskey, brandy, various kinds of wine, especially Moselle. But my wine-bibbing days are long over. I like a spot of brandy. Going to bed. That's all. You see, the necessities of life are now 2 guineas a bottle. Well, of course, I keep my eye on passing events, but I'm not much influenced by them. I'm too old to be influenced. I've seen such an awful lot, you see, in 85 years. All the stuff that Macmillan talks now, well, I've heard Gladstone talk the same stuff when I was younger. And it's all the same stuff all over again. When I used to hear Gladstone and Lord Salisbury of my day and Joe Chamberlain, of course, I thought what they said had some sense in it. But in every generation since, I've listened to the same stuff from the same kind of people until now. It simply sounds like windbeggery. May seem like sense to a young man hearing it for the first time, but it doesn't seem like sense to a man that's listened to the same stuff for 60 or 70 years. The same old weary stuff over and over and over again. Never come to the point. Never use one word if 10 will do. Look at all this nonsense about Berlin. Everybody knows it's not going to lead to war. Nobody supposes for a single moment there's going to be a war about it. And yet they try to make our flesh creep by pretending that there might be one. You see them building hundreds of new houses if they're going to be knocked down a week after next, wouldn't you? I live in a world of young people, and my thoughts are always with them, or nearly always with them. And I think their influence does keep me young. Every character of Greyfriars is a living person to me. They haven't aged. I've aged a bit myself. Bunter goes on like Peter Pan, his horse like Tithonus. You can't be a Peter Pan in real life, but you can in fiction. I haven't changed much at all. Actually, you know, people don't change. I don't think I'd change a sentence or a syllable. Except there's one thing. I wouldn't be 85. I would stick at about 72. That's a very nice age. I am young at 85, but I don't know why, unless Providence had a special eye on me. Now, that would be rather a cheekless about that. I begin to feel a bit like Robinson Crusoe on his island. Everybody nearly is dead. Extraordinary. All the old crowd up at the Peak Warehouse, there used to be such a lot of them. And I don't believe there's one left now. There's Chapman, the artist, and myself. But I don't believe there's a single one of the old crowd left there now. They were enthusiastic about it. Oh, and they made a big success of it, too. They had tremendous circulations. I don't know the exact figures, but I think the magnet sometimes rose to 250,000. The gem, not so much as that. But I never knew the right figures. Oh, if I did, I've forgotten them. But their holiday annual, the Great Prize Annual, if you ever came across it, that used to sell up to 70,000 copies. You can't sell annuals like that now. 1925 to 1935, I think, was the best. I did my best work then, I think. Out of there, about 65. Funny thing, I remember in the wartime when I turned 70, I got a bit of a jolt, feeling that I was getting old. Very comic, that was. Because I don't feel like that now. That's 15 years ago. You remember in Tennyson, the young man says, what shall I be at 50 if nature keeps me alive? If I find the world so bitter when I am but 25? Well, I think I made a rather nicer version of that. What shall I be at 90 if nature keeps me alive? When I find the world so jolly when I'm only 85?